Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome in to another edition of The Sit Down Mafia History Podcast. I am your host, Jeff Nadeau. Hope you're having a great night wherever you are. And it's that time of the week for yet another mafia topic we're going to talk about today on The Sit Down. Hope you had a good week. Hope you are getting past this cold weather. Had a lot of snow around the East Coast and different areas. One place that's not snowing is Florida, and we could all be so lucky to be. Our co-host, Blackjack Fletcher, you're back for another episode. Blackjack, how's your week? How you feeling?
It's been good, buddy. I went to the Pegasus World Cup down at Gulfstream Park over the weekend. You know, it's not snowing here, Jeff, but we did have record low temperatures, 30 degrees last week.
Damn.
Very cold for Florida, very cold, but, you know, still highs of like 58. So I don't feel bad for you guys.
I know a lot of our listeners, some are gamblers, some are horse bettors. I know I'm sure some people watched Life is Good find its way to victory lane against the competition. We'll see what's next for that horse. Irad Ortiz called it the best horse he's ever ridden, which how good Irad is. So that's pretty
good. He looked like it. I think that I do think that Joel Rosario gave Nick Sko a bad trip. I think that he held him back too far, but there's no disputing that in every big race this year, you know, from Dubai to Saratoga to the Breeders' Cup, where Life is Good is going to be a major player.
Yeah, pretty incredible. But hope everyone had a good week. We are back with another show. Had a great episode last week on Crazy Joe Gallo. Got a lot of people that reached out and said they enjoyed that show. Today we have an interesting show. We were going to talk about Vito Genovese, and I'm working on a possible pretty cool guest. I had a lot going on today. So what I'm going to do, we're going to kind of push that back to next week. We got a great one today. This is one that I've gotten some requests about. People ask me all the time about Michael Meldish, East Harlem Purple Gang, Stephen Crea, what's going on there. One of the last mob hits was actually back in 2013. An individual named Michael Meldish was killed in the Throgs Neck section of the Bronx. And a lot of people wondered who had the balls to kill Michael Meldish. Michael Meldish is a pretty interesting guy. I get asked all the time as well, you know, if you could have one killer from history kill for you, who would it be? You'd be hard pressed to find someone that was more feared than Michael Meldish. Him and his group, the East Harlem Purple Gang, were ruthless. They were someone in a group that sold, you know, kilos and kilos of drugs. They killed many people. And he would turn up dead in 2013. And a lot of people wondered what exactly went on. We're going to talk about that hit today. We're going to talk about a name synonymous with the Lucchese crime family, really since the 80s, someone that made a large jump in that family and also ultimately would be jammed up for taking part in that murder. The case is still active, and we're going to get into all that today. We're going to talk about the life and times of Stephen Crea. Crea, a pretty interesting name out of the Bronx. So we'll get to that in just a second. I do want to say thank you to everybody who's checking out the show. We have a great month of those planned for you. I want you to check us out on Twitter at the Sit Down 7, where we tweet out updates on the show and all sorts of other great mob content. I also want to advise all of you, go check us out on YouTube. You can find the Sit Down on YouTube as well. We do a lot of cool videos on there and some great interviews that you won't necessarily hear on the show. You can check that on YouTube, the Sit Down. Blackjack, what do you say we get into Stephen Crea? I have to ask, how is everything with sports betting, everything working out? We're close to the Super Bowl. We'll have to do a little prediction next week on the Super Bowl.
Yeah, we definitely will. It's an interesting Super Bowl, right? I don't think anybody beginning of the year would have had Rams-Bengals as the Super Bowl. But here we sit with Cincinnati and Los Angeles going at it a couple of weeks from now. 2 years in a row, Jeff, a team is going to host the Super Bowl in their own stadium. It's funny how these things happen. You know, we went 54 years without it happening, and now 2 years in a row we're going to get it.
Yeah, pretty incredible. We'll talk about that next week. One thing about YouTube and why you need to follow us on YouTube is because sometimes I'll put interviews on there that we don't put on the show. And I'm actually interviewing a guy next week, Blackjack, that actually relates to football and to gambling and to the mob. I'm going to talk to an individual that was part of a bookmaking operation for the Chicago Outfit for many years. Rubbed elbows with some really interesting people in Chicago, and now he makes his living in Las Vegas and in Florida betting on sports. So we're going to talk to him. So, you know, kind of in the grand scheme of getting ready for the Super Bowl, that should be fun. But what do you say we get into Stephen Crea? Now, I do want to make a point, and this is something that I want to advise everybody about as we go into this episode. I was in contact with Crea's son. Crea's son is a paralegal. And I actually contacted him about his father's case and about what he's got going on. He actually hosts a podcast about law and things of that nature. And he actually advised me, and something that I find interesting, we haven't really ever heard of this before. So if you were to Google Stephen Crea, if you were to look him up, what you're going to see is that he goes by the name Wonder Boy or Stevie Wonder. I spoke to Dom Crea, the son, and he actually told me that other than the federal government, there is no one that calls him Stephen Wonderboy Crea, interestingly enough, and that the government actually aligned him with that nickname basically to kind of drum up interest, I guess, around him. That's not a name he goes by. I've heard of that once in a while where someone's called something that they're not necessarily called. So I just wanted to kind of make that known, kind of an interesting point about Crea. This guy is in litigation still, and we're going to talk about the case that he's involved with. Blatchy, have you read into this case at all? Do you know anything about it?
I have. And it's a case that's kind of familiar to me because, as you said, it's relatively recent.
Yeah.
So it's something that I remember happening at the time. And I've refreshed myself on it.
Yeah, let's get into it. Stephen Crea on the sit down. Stephen Crea was born July 18, 1947 in the Bronx, New York. He would grow up on Arthur Avenue. Now, as we know, this is kind of our time to promote something. Arthur Avenue, if you've never been to New York, you've never been to the Bronx, it is imperative that if you ever come here, you go to the Arthur Avenue area. What a terrific Italian enclave that's really one of the final ones in New York, isn't it? So many great restaurants and eateries and just different Italian places, coffee shops and bars and all sorts of things. Bacci, have you been to Arthur Avenue?
I have. My dad grew up not far from there. So I've taken many trips around that neighborhood.
Very cool. I never knew that, actually. I feel like I know a lot about you. I did not know your dad grew up around Arthur Avenue. How about that?
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll have to, once we get past like the winter here, Blackjack and I have to meet in New York and maybe go to a couple of these spots, maybe go to Sparks. We'll go to Pasquale's Rigoletto and Arthur Ave. But Stephen Crea was lucky enough to grow up and live in that area. And he'd actually remain in the Bronx really his entire life. He would eventually move up more into Westchester County, but he had a social club that he would frequent in Pelham Bay. And he was always someone that made the Bronx involved in what he was up to and some of the haunts he was in. It would actually almost get him killed at one point, which we'll talk about. Coming up, Stephen Crea would become affiliated with the Lucchese crime family. He'd work under an individual named Sammy Bones Castaldi. Now, the interesting thing about the Lucchese's is most of the history of the Lucchese's really centers around Manhattan, Queens, and in Brooklyn. If we know anything about Tony Carollo, who was the boss in the 80s, he actually was based out of Queens. I know he was up in Whitestone, and that was kind of where the haunts of the family was. There really wasn't much affiliation in the Bronx, and Castaldi really had the only Bronx crew. But Stephen Crea would come up under Castaldi, and he'd ultimately, in the 80s, become a made man under Tony Ducks. Now, a little bit of background on the Lucchese family. We talked about this when we talked about Tony Carollo. One thing about the Lucchese's we have to be interested in is the fact of how good they were in labor racketeering. Okay, that's something that obviously Tommy Lucchese himself was integral in. We could make the case that he's really one of the great labor racketeers and construction people in the history of the mob. His proteges, whether it was Johnny Dio, whether it was Tony Corral, they would all really follow in his steps of really getting involved in unions. That's where the money was. They kind of recognized this is where we can grow our profile. This is where we can gain political connections. Someone like Frank Costello and the Genovese family, he knew that. Everyone and anyone that was something in the mob, Blackjack, knew that union infiltration was the quickest way to become very rich and make a lot of money for your family.
Yeah, I mean, listen, getting involved with those unions at that time, you know, construction was popping up all over New York City. And those guys were the way to a constant flow of money, right? Because the unions would go from one job to the next to the next. It's like, for anyone who spent time in Miami recently, right? Like, you go to Miami, what do you see? The skyline is dominated by cranes because they're constantly building. That's what New York City was in the 60s and 70s and 80s. It was constant development. And these unions were a way to have constant money coming in. So yeah, it was a way to really ensure that you'd always have big time money coming in.
Plus, again, there was a lot of control with owning and running unions, and power comes from control. And that's something that, you know, you could also use unions to launder money. There's just all sorts of ways that you can create no-show jobs. You can control skimming. You control all that stuff. So it really puts a stranglehold and really ultimately ends up hurting the consumer at the end of the day, which we've kind of talked about a bit before. So Stephen Crea becomes a made man in the 1980s, and he would recognize, like the people before him, that the quickest way to power and money in the family was becoming incredibly proficient in labor racketeering. He would quickly anoint himself and get involved with unions. He would have no-show jobs at multiple different construction companies, including a drywall company in New York. He also ran Local 608, which is the Carpenters Union out of New York City. And he was involved with Union 282, which is the Concrete and Cement Workers Union. Interestingly enough, 608 was actually dissolved and disbanded back in the early 2010s after the unions would recognize that it was way too mob controlled to ever continue being in business. So, you know, a lot of these unions are mob controlled, mob related, and some of them are even, you know, full of mobsters, some of these, you know, local unions in Manhattan and things of that nature. So, you know, he was making a move quickly into the foray of unions. In 1983, the area in Yonkers that faced the Hudson River needed a revitalization. And that year, the city decides that we're going to put, you know, multi-millions of dollars into the waterfront. We're going to hire these developers to take it over and make it look better. We've seen that happen in many places, whether it's Philadelphia or wherever. And again, as we know in the 80s, Nicky Scarfo did this in Philadelphia when they created Penn's Landing. He was sending people to lean on these developers, try to get them to give up control. And that's exactly what Stephen Crea did. He contacted an individual named Melvin Weintraub, who was the developer that won the bid on this case and would ultimately wrestle control away from him. And he was involved in his first real big project. If you go to that area today, some of these locations are still there. This is how you do what you have to do. This is how you make the big money. You muscle in, and this was the mob logic. This is where the commission stuff would end up coming down. They were getting into these really heavy city-run contracts, city-run businesses, and Stephen Crea found real early that was the thing to do.
Well, I mean, if you can get in on one of those deals, you're talking about massive amounts of money, right? And a place like Yonkers, too, is such a prime spot because Yonkers has been under, we'll call it redevelopment, for the last 40 years. I mean, they're constantly trying to redevelop Yonkers. It's been an ongoing thing. It never really takes, but they're spending a ton of money there and they've got a lot of government grants, and that essentially is free money. And so it's a very enticing lure for the mob to get involved in.
As we know, in 1985, there would start to be some changes, though, in the Lucchese crime family. As we know, Rudolph Giuliani and the federal government would drop the commission case and arrest really all the members of the five families, Paul Castellano, Tony Salerno, everyone involved, Paul Castellano. Tony Corallo would also be hemmed up, and this would be the end for Corallo. He would get a 100-year-plus prison sentence, and there would need to be new leadership in the Lucchese crime family. He makes the decision because, as we talked about this during the Paul Varry episode, after Tony Corallo, the problem that he had no capable individual to take this family to the next step. He was kind of forced to give it to the hands of lunatics like Anthony Casso and Vic Amuso. So he kind of creates this, acting boss, front boss type of thing. And Casso and Amuso are in charge of the family. This would be good, though, for Stephen Crea. He would ultimately take over the crew that he was once in, run by Sammy Bones Castaldi. So he had the representation up in the Bronx. And, you know, with a new boss comes new responsibility. But as we've said, Blackjack, the issue that Tony Crowell had was there just wasn't real capable leadership behind him. And giving the jobs to Anthony Casso was suicide.
Anthony Casso was, as you said, a lunatic, right? And the problem was there's a power vacuum at the top because you've got guys like Casso who are just crazy people, and it's going to affect everyone all the way down on this chart. And that really was the problem that the Lucchesis had at this point is you don't have a strong figure at the top who's able to run things, and you've got these nut jobs who are out here going off half-cocked on their own, and that's just going to lead to problems for everyone else down the line.
Right. And, you know, as we know, I mean, whether it was a Musso or a Casso, they were power hungry. They were if they went to jail, they were going to try to run the family regardless. And anyone trying to muscle in was going to be killed. And Casso was just a psycho. We've talked about that. And I urge you, if you haven't heard it, go check out that episode we did.
Yeah, definitely.
Ultimately, in the early 90s, though, the government would rain down on Anthony Casso and Victor Amuso, and they still try to maintain some sort of control. There would be kind of an acting body that would be created. But one of the individuals that would rise in power was yet again Stephen Crea. So within 10 years, basically, he went from being a made man all the way up to becoming underboss of the Lucchese crime family. He was on the governing board of directors, basically, in the Lucchese crime family. That would not only anger and make Casso furious, but it would also make people in the family mad, guys that were loyal to Casso and to Amuso. The thing that Crea wanted to do is he wanted more of the power base of the Lucchese crime family to be in the Bronx. That's where he was from. He felt like that was a breeding ground for more earning, for more things to be done. And he moved the power base up to the Bronx. And that was something that really angered not only Casso, but loyalists like George Zappola and an individual named Frank Gioia.
Yeah.
So it
makes sense, Jeff, because again, you think about it, Amuso and Casso kind of put Crea in this underboss role, but even though he's the underboss, he's almost like the street boss at this time.
Right.
Because these guys are locked up. He's the guy on the street and he decides, you know what? I want to make changes. I want to do it my way. And now all of a sudden they say, whoa, 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 whoa. He's maybe getting a little too big for his britches. Maybe we need to do something about this. But in reality, you're the guy who put him there.
Right. And what ultimately would happen is they would order Stephen Crea killed. So they give the contract to Frank Lastorino. Now, Lastorino, Big Frank Lastorino, was a mob hitman for the Lucchesis. He had been involved with multiple hits. Many people believe he was involved with killing Bobby Borriello, the friend of Gotti and Gotti Jr. He was also wanted in involvement in killing Bruno Facchiola. Facchiola was a Lucchese crime family member who was actually last seen with Tommy DeSimone before he was killed. Big Frank was a big time hitman and he would be given the job to kill Stephen Crea. The problem was it never ended up happening because all of those individuals that were caught up in all this were actually hemmed up as well by the Fed. So things were turning good for Stephen Crea. He was a high end caliber individual in the crime family. And, you know, the people that wanted him dead were now gone, basically. So, you know, he would kind of be able to work in peace and he wouldn't have to worry about it anymore. By, you know, basically the early 90s, he's a high up, he's making a lot of money and construction projects were coming in aplenty. The mob in New York, particularly Lucchese crime family, were making a lot of money. They were involved with construction groups. They had mob taxes initiated. They were skimming. They were fixing bids. They were rigging things. They were creating income to the IRS. And there was one interesting thing that Stephen Crea decides to create. He creates a business called the Lucchese Construction Group. Wasn't exactly a name that, I mean, maybe he could have came up with a different name, but
maybe something a little more conspicuous.
Yeah. I mean, come on, man. I mean, that's about as obvious as it gets. But they were making a lot of money. It was estimated that during the 90s, there were years where the Lucchese crime family was bringing in upwards of $50 million a year, from construction. And You know, this was Stephen Kriya. It was creating capital. It was being an earner. It was making a lot of money through unions and union construction. And it was big money for the family.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the name aside, it was a great idea, right? Because you create this organization where you can legitimize what you're doing illegally. You can put your guys on the payroll. They can have legitimate income to report to the IRS. Everything looks legitimate. The name, again, is an awful name because you name it after a crime family. It's a terrible name. But the idea behind it is really solid because now everything that you're doing illegally, the bribes, the payments, everything else can be reported as legitimate income. So it really gives you an out to a lot of what the government's going to come after you for. Again, the name is just an abomination.
Yeah, it's a rough one. Now, during all this, Stephen Kriya would have some sons. I actually talked about one of them. He would also have another son called Stevie D. Kriya, Stephen Jr. He would actually get involved as his father is making hay in the mob. He would get involved with a group called the Tanglewood Boys. Now, yep. The Tanglewood Boys were basically a recruitment farm team for the mob. They specifically worked for the Lucchese crime family. They operated out of a shopping center in Yonkers, and it was made aware to people that in the 90s, Stephen Kriya Jr. came up in that group. Now, they would all kind of work out of the Bronx. At one point, Stephen Kriya had a social club called the Coddington Club on Coddington Avenue. Kriya Jr. had a gambling club. These were Bronx guys, and they were, outside of the Gambinos, there was not a ton of representation of them. There were a couple, and Bananas had a couple people up there, but for the most part, this was an area run by the Lucchese family. So Stephen Kriya's son was also becoming a known commodity in the mob. Towards the end of the 90s, it would all kind of come apart for Stephen Kriya, though, and he would have to face the first possibility that he was going to go to prison. In 2000, he would be involved alongside many others in a wide-ranging state and federal case involving mob crimes, whether it was bribery, extortion, bid rigging, tax laws, all sorts of different things, and the feds would hem him up. One of the real problems that Stephen Kriya had was he was alongside an abducted member, Joe DiTillo. They were involved with a person called Sean Richard. Richard was the son-in-law of the New Jersey-based Cavalcanti family. Their boss, John Riggi, was his father-in-law. He was in construction. He started doing business with Kriya and this DiTillo. And, he was a rat. And he was recording them. They were talking about bribery and all sorts of different things. And this is what ultimately would get Stephen Kriya hemmed up. He would be charged on multiple counts, including labor racketeering, bid rigging, enterprise corruption, and labor racketeering. The good thing for him, though, was he was able to kind of get a pretty favorable plea agreement. And Stephen Kriya would get sentenced to 34 months in early January of 2004. So, it ended up not being too bad, quite frankly. I mean, 34 months, it's under 3 years for all that. Not a bad. And again, by this point, Stephen Kriya, it's 2000. Stephen Kriya is, 53 years old. He'd only been to prison this for 3 years, basically. Not bad.
Yeah. And when you consider the fact that the feds and the state had him on charges and they agreed to run them concurrently, which you and I both know, Jeff, if the feds want to jam you up, they don't have to do that.
Right.
This is a very generous sentence for him. And I think, again, what you said is probably the reason why, that he's in his 50s with no criminal record at that point. It's hard to make the argument for an enhanced penalty.
Right. And so he really wouldn't be in jail too long. In 2006, Stephen Kriya would actually be released from prison. And he would be under supervised release until 2009, but wasn't all bad, quite honestly. Basically spent about 2 years in jail. Yeah. He comes home. He's not able to associate with felons. He has to kind of stay at home and things of that nature. But it's not too bad all in all. Like I said, he's in his 50s. He had done really, he hasn't done any prison time really up until then. Stephen Kriya would get off paper in 2010 and he would head right back to the Coddington Club, which was his social club. He would be seen regularly on walk and talks with mobsters, including a guy called Big John Castellucci. John is actually a current member still of the family. He's doing time for racketeering. He was involved with the Brooklyn Crew. He was, interestingly enough, Black Chick, if I go back to the Concrete and Cement Workers Union, he was actually a member of that union. And it was kind of wondered, what are they talking about? They're probably getting back into construction. He was regularly seen. As soon as he got out, Stephen Crear was right back into the streets, and he was talking with members of the family, and they were doing planning on what the next big score was in construction.
I mean, that's what guys do, right? I mean, this is what your life is. So, you know, he did his time in prison, and then he abided by the restrictions that were placed on him for essentially 3 years after he got out on parole. But then once he's free and clear, yeah, it's time to go back to work. It's time to start earning it again, right? I mean, if you think about it from start to finish, it was about 5 years that he wasn't able to earn. It's time to get back out on the streets and do what you got to do.
Yeah, and one of the issues that big John Castellucci had is there were a lot of people that were not willing to take orders from him. He would be involved in made capo regime, and a lot of people would not take orders from him. He was involved with kind of not doing anything in certain situations involving Bonanno crime family members. He was kind of looked at down on. A lot of the older guys didn't really respect him and that sort of thing. But at the end of the day, Stephen Crear was back out on the streets, and John Castellucci was someone that he could do business with and needed to do business with. Something would happen in 2012, though, to Michael or to Stephen Crear. Outside one of his son's gambling clubs, he would get into a beef with, to this day, it is an unknown Bonanno associate. Nobody has any idea who it was, but he would get into an argument, the elder Crear, with this Bonanno associate. He would call him names and things of that nature, and I guess assaults Crear. And that would be something that would come back to obviously bite Crear here in a little bit. But according to the federal government, Stephen Crear would go to his son, Stephen Crear Jr., and basically say, look, this guy's got to fucking go, according to the feds. Now, that individual was never killed, but this would be a big problem for Stephen Crear in just a little bit that we'll get to. So he's out. Everything's good. He's back to making money. But as we know, in 2013, something would happen that would really change the future for Stephen Crear. In 2013, on November 15th of that year, towards the end of 2013, there was a murder in the Bronx. It would happen at 1212 Ellsworth Avenue in Throgs Neck. There was a body discovered inside of a Lincoln LS sedan. Now, the door was wide open. The body was filled with bullet holes. And it ended up being ruthless Purple Gang leader Michael Meldish. And a lot of people wonder, what's the Purple Gang? The Purple Gang was a street gang, basically, that was developed in Harlem many years ago. And it would ultimately become one of the biggest drug trafficking organizations in New York. In the 70s and 80s, the Italian Purple Gang and other African-American gangs would basically merge, and they were selling weight. It's that simple. They were making a lot of money. They had become a ruthless organization. And when you are a organization like the East Harlem Purple Gang, you have to kill people. There were a lot of people killed by this group. And this was a very powerful gang. At one point, a lot of people thought they may be the sixth family at one point. They were making a lot of money through narcotics. They had connections in the French Connection. They were making big money. And the reputed leader at the time was Michael Meldish. Now, Michael Meldish's brother Joe was also involved, and he was a hitman. By the early and late 70s, the Purple Gang had almost 30 members and 80 associates. So they were becoming higher end membership wise. At some points, they were basically looking like, you know, the Colombo family almost. I mean, that's about numbers that they were having at certain points. So, you know, this was a group that was definitely making a lot of money. They were doing a lot of things, and they basically ran, you know, on their own. Now, Michael Meldish was the individual killed. A lot of people around New York wondered who would kill Michael Meldish. I mean, this is a guy that was notorious. He was ruthless. And, you know, people wondered. In 2017, there would be a 19-person indictment of Lucchese family members. It was a wide-range indictment that would basically call on, you know, different members to be arrested, including Stephen Crear, the boss of the family, Matty Madonna, Big John Castellucci, Stephen Crea Jr., and then two individuals named Christopher Londonio and Terrence Caldwell. Now, according to the federal government, Caldwell and Londonio were the hitters that, according to them, killed Michael Meldish. Now, we're not going to get into the whole hit and everything, but they were led to believe through a call that, and this was said by informants in the case, they would say that a lot of this had to do with a phone call Londonio would make directly after the hit. It was about a 2-minute call that he made to Matthew Madonna. Now, Blackjack, that's kind of your smoking gun of evidence. Would that be enough for you to find someone guilty of something?
No, that's real light, man. That's a 2-minute phone call. I mean, unless you have an abject confession in there, which you don't have here, it's not going to be enough, right? Like, you have to be able to back that up. And this is something that most people don't realize. Even if you get a confession from someone, you still have to be able to substantiate that confession. It isn't enough on its own to convict somebody in a criminal court. So even if someone confesses, there still has to be objective proof that the confession is real, because there are times when people give false confessions. It's not common, but it does happen. So no, this would not be what I would consider to be proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right. And who's to say that the 2-minute call wasn't, hey, Matt, I've got the cannolis you wanted. I'm going to bring them by our house.
It could be exactly. It could be anything. And also, it could be someone trying to set someone else up. Like, you don't know. That's why you need outside proof to substantiate that confession. I can get on a phone call right now, Jeff, and say, hey, Jeff Nadeau told me to take this guy out. It's done. How do they know that's true?
Right. And that was the thing. So the feds come up with this big time indictment, the big takedown, and everyone was jammed up. Matt Madonna was hit with murder native racketeering. And same with Stephen Crea. There were other charges as well. Stephen Crea Jr. would be involved with conspiracy to commit murder. And that would have to do with the individual that his father got in a fight with. They would have contend that Crea and Crea Jr. conspired to kill that individual. Also involved John Castellucci, who got hit with a racketeering conspiracy. And an individual named Paulie Roast Beef Cassano, he would get charged with conspiracy to commit assault, native racketeering. So there was loan sharking, there was gambling, there was drug trafficking. It was a huge indictment for the feds involving the higher end brass of the Lucchese crime family. Now, interestingly enough, I want to start with Crea Sr. In 2019, after a 6-week trial, he would be convicted of this crime and sentenced to life in prison. Now, I just want to talk about this. This is fascinating. According to a polygraph test administered by a guy called Jeremiah Hannafin, who gave more than 2,500 lie detector tests during his career with the FBI, he would give Stephen Crea a lie detector. Now, again, Blackjack, tell me about lie detectors in cases.
They're notoriously unreliable. They're not admissible in court. And the reason that they're not admissible in court is because polygraphs measure changes in your blood pressure when you give your responses. So the logic behind a polygraph machine is most people get nervous when they lie. There are some people that can fake a polygraph. Like, if you are a sociopath, you will have no problem with a polygraph. Do I believe that, for instance, Jeff, something that most people can understand, do I think O.J. Simpson could pass a polygraph? Yes, I do. I think O.J. Simpson has probably convinced himself at this point in his life that he's not guilty of those murders. A polygraph is not indicative of anything other than your nervousness when you're taking that test. And, you know, some people say, well, everyone's nervous when they take it. Yes, but most people get uncomfortable lying, especially when they know someone's looking for it. So they tense up, they get nervous, their blood pressure goes up. That's all it measures, is your blood pressure in response to the question. It's why it has never been allowed into court. It's why it never will be allowed into court. However, I will say that when you have somebody, and this is a critical thing about polygraphs, a polygraph is only as good as the person asking the questions. Because in my experience as a criminal defense attorney, I've seen many people give polygraphs, and some of them are god-awful. right? Some of them are terrible. They jump right into it. They start asking questions right off the bat. Some of them kind of ease you into it and get you where you want to be. And that's really what you want. If you want an accurate polygraph, you want a calm subject. You don't want someone that you're trying to catch off guard. So a really good polygraph examiner will start you off with easy questions to put you at ease. You know, what's your name? Is this person your sister? Is this the name of your mother? Is this the town you grew up in? You get a bunch of yeses in a row to kind of measure a baseline. And then they'll ask you, they won't just jump in with a surprise question. It'll be, did you know the victim? Did you ever encounter the victim? You know, and they'll build up to it to kind of show a trajectory. So the examiner is really important. And when you say in this case that you have an FBI examiner, which is as good as there is, who's been doing it for 25 years, I tend to give more credence to what his results are.
Yeah. So keep in mind, Stephen Crea would be given a test, and he would, according to the tester, he would exonerate Crea. Now, again, as you said, there's nothing in court that can be used here. Stephen Jr. was asked, basically, did you ever direct anyone to murder Michael Meldish, including Londonio, Terry Caldwell, or Madonna? Crea answered no, and the other answers were not indicative of deception, Hannafin wrote. He would also answer no to whether he had planned the murder of Meldish with anyone, including his father or acting boss, Matty Madonna. And again, Crea Jr.'s response was not indicative of deception. So again, take that for what it is. Crea Jr. would ultimately get a 13-year prison term for racketeering. He was not found guilty of, and it wasn't, he didn't get found guilty. He just accepted a plea agreement. But Crea Sr., there's a lot of evidence that kind of point to that maybe he didn't do this. Now, we have to ask ourselves, this is just our opinion. Stephen Crea never instructed anyone to kill anyone, as far as I know, throughout his mob career. He had only did a few years in prison. There also was a lot of people involved with this case as far as rats are concerned. Frank Pasqua III, John Panisi. There's some really evidence that you have to kind of wonder about. Butchick, in reading about this case, what are your thoughts on it?
I tend to fall on the same side you do, Jeff. I think that Crea has a few things working in his favor. First, he wasn't a guy who was a hothead. He wasn't a guy who was quick to go for the throat. And there's no evidence that, like you said, he ever ordered a hit on anybody else. Number two, the polygraph is sort of a thing for me because of who conducted it, right? Like, this wasn't a guy who was some hack for hire. This is a guy who worked for the FBI, a guy who put bad guys away, right? This is a guy who probably, even though you're paying him to do the polygraph, was probably going to be pretty objective and know how to do it right. And the fact that Crea shows no signs of deception at all would indicate to me that he probably is telling the truth. Also just the fact that he took the polygraph, because at that point, you know it's inadmissible. Why take it? Like, what's the benefit to you other than you saying, I know I didn't do this, I want to get it out, right? Like, if you knew you committed a crime and you would only take the polygraph thinking you could game it. If you knew you didn't do it, you would take the polygraph saying, hey, listen, I want to show you, I want to prove it. You're proving your innocence here. I tend to give a little bit of credence to what you're saying, that I think Crea probably wasn't directly involved in this.
The feds would also use a jailhouse snitch called David Evangelista, who claims that Christopher Londonio would tell him, quote, Stevie gave me the order to kill Michael Meldish. Now, again, that's his word against Mr. Londonio.
A jailhouse snitch, you could wipe your ass with that, okay? Because any person who is a jailhouse snitch has one agenda and one agenda only, and that's to get out sooner. Okay. I think it is absurd that we even use them. Okay. They are the most impeachable witnesses you can possibly have.
Yeah. In fact, like, I'm kind of blown away that this case that has went this far with Stephen Crea. I talked to the son, and he told me that the family and the lawyers have filed a Rule 33. They're kind of in the awaiting processes of possibly a new trial. They're obviously going to go through the appeals. But when you look at this case, I mean, I don't understand what the evidence is, quite frankly. I guess.
Yeah. And how many of these episodes have we talked about government overreach, right? And that's what it is here, plain and simple. Stephen Crea was rising up the ranks of the Lucchese family. He was, for all intents and purposes, the street boss of the Lucchese family. And that makes him a target. And again, you know, people will, we've had occasional people listen to the show and say, oh, well, you're defending these guys, you're glorifying these guys. No, I'm not. I'm simply, as someone with a legal background, I abhor the government overreaching to put people in prison. If you can catch someone committing a crime and prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, they should go to prison. The government has every advantage in a criminal trial. If you have to overreach, you shouldn't be doing it.
And a lot of people are wondering, why did this happen? Why was Michael Meldish rubbed out? Now, a lot of people wonder, you know, according to Evangelista, he would say that Madonna ordered the hit after Meldish became disrespectful to the boss. I guess there was also a rumor that Meldish was dating a woman that Madonna used to be with. And there was also rumors that Terrence Caldwell, who was a mob associate, he actually had killed four gangs before for the mob before, according to the feds. You know, and he would also, Evangelista, testify, quote, that the black guy named Terry was the guy that was recruited to kill Meldish. So, and, you know, he would, Ladonio, act as the getaway driver. But I mean, outside of that, there's really not much here. Now, there's also a rumor that Michael Meldish owed money as well. There's also been some rumors about the Bonanno crime family being involved, which is totally different than what we're hearing here. But it also doesn't help that Londonio actually planned to escape from MDC Brooklyn, which, I don't know, doesn't... This guy seems like the odd man out in all this. He seems like kind of the nutty guy in all this. But uh-huh. I don't know. In my opinion, look, I don't know the exact... every part of this case, but it comes across as a bit flimsy to me. We'll see if Stephen Crea gets another trial, but actually, what do you think? If you had to guess.
I would say he doesn't get a new trial. It's very hard for appellate courts to overturn a jury verdict. You have to show some sort of significant malfeasance by the prosecution. It's very, very hard to overturn a jury verdict. So I would say he's not going to get a new trial.
And there is one thing that we do have to remember. In the case on murder, okay, it is possible that he gets a new trial. We do have to mention, though, Stephen Crea is 74 years old. And let's just be frank, he is pretty involved with the other crimes in this case, including some of the construction things that he was doing. Now, I want to talk quickly about some of his experience in construction, even late in his career. I want to talk about the Bronx Lebanon Hospital, which is a hospital up in the Bronx that caters to low-income individuals. The state of New York was involved with basically a facelift on that company, on that hospital. In this major mob takedown, there are a lot of charges related to union rigging and construction and all that sort of thing. Stephen Crea had ties to a company called Sparrow Construction. They were in charge of basically building the annex and doing other things inside the Bronx Lebanon Hospital. They would bill the hospital $26 million for the renovation. However, only $21 million of actual work was done. They would do things like the HVAC system needed to be replaced. They would say it would cost $2.3 million, but they would say it cost $5 million. And they were falsifying invoice and change orders to make way more money. So you have to ask yourself, where did the $5 million at the end that they shouldn't have got, where did that money go? Now, the 642-bed hospital obviously needed a lot of work done, and most of the revenue that comes is from Medicaid and things like that. But this would be a big thing because this is one thing. Stephen Crea, according to what I know, was involved in like every part of this. He had cleaning crews. He had all sorts of things that were involved in this, and they were making a ton of money through stuff like that. So Is it possible that Stephen Creel was not involved with the hit on Michael Meldish? Possibly, maybe, who knows? But at the end of the day, he was still very involved. And at 74 years old, you have to wonder, I mean, how many years does he have left?
Yeah, not very many, right? I mean, objectively, probably not very many. Your life expectancy has to decrease significantly in prison. And I don't see a viable path for him getting out, Jeff. I just think that his trial was done reasonably cleanly. There's no overtly questionable rulings by the court. It's just a government overreach, but the jury bought it and they convicted him. And that's a very hard thing to overturn.
Yeah, definitely kind of an interesting case. We'll see what happens. Obviously, like I said, the son would tell me that there's newly discovered evidence and they're kind of waiting for some good news. We'll see. Is Stephen Crea a murderer? I don't think. Is he a convicted mobster? Yeah, he is. And that's been pretty much proven. But kind of an interesting story nonetheless. This was the last mob hit. You said you remembered when this happened, Michael Meldish?
Yeah, I kind of remember hearing about it because, like you said, Jeff, there wasn't a ton of mob hits happening around that time. I mean, it kind of slowed down. And when those things happen, it made news.
Yeah, keep in mind at the time, Michael Meldish was 62. And like I said, at the current age, Stephen Crea is 74. All four individuals, Madonna, Crea, Caldwell, and Londoni, are all in federal prison. And we'll see. I have to admit, some will not be let out. I don't know if any of these guys will let out. I know the family of Crea hopes and prays that they'll get another shot, but we'll see. I mean, there's a lot of flimsy testimony in this case. We'll see if they can prove beyond a reason about it. Maybe they'll have to do it again. We'll see. We'll keep you updated nonetheless. Not an incredibly long episode this week. We're going to be back next week with a big time show. We're going to get into some really heavy hitters over the next couple of weeks. Vito Genovese comes to mind. I know people have asked me about Tony Spilotro, Carlos Marcello. And we still have so many mobsters to do, Blackjack. It's really a never ending show, isn't it?
It is. And that's what makes this show great, is there's always new topics to cover. It's a fun show to do, Jeff. You know, I look forward to doing it every week with you. You know, we talk about it and it's a lot of fun. And I hope that all of you listening to it enjoy it as much as we enjoy doing it.
Yeah, 100%. But yeah, I felt it important that we do this one just because it was the last sanctioned hit, basically, as far as we know, and according to the government. So the streets of the Bronx are a little less quiet with people like Stephen Crea not around. We'll get back next week with another great episode. As always, if you enjoy the show, make sure you give us a deserved rating. Make sure you comment. Let us know what you think. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at The Sit Down 7. And like I said, follow us on YouTube, The Sit Down. We continue to gain subscribers there and just kind of build the brand, as they say. That's the goal when you have a podcast, build the brand. Blackjack, what do you have going on?
I mean, we got the Super Bowl coming up in 2 weeks, Jeff. So it's a big time with the run up to that over at betterthanvegas.com. And, you know, we're getting ready for the big game.
Yeah, it should be fun. And I'm sure we'll get into some predictions next week on the show. As I said, Vito Genovese on the show next week, kind of the, another one of those real lunatics who, you know, definitely had no issue making his waves in the mob. We'll talk about that and more next week here on another episode of The Sit Down. I am Jeff Nadeau. He is Blackjack Fletcher. We'll see you next week here on The Sit Down.